720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. It is beautiful and sunny outside. It's still a little bit chilly out there, but it is beautiful and sunny and lovely. And so I am most grateful to you for spending part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Lots and lots to do here today on the program, so let us get into it, shall we? We're joined now by phone by our good friend Lisa Dietland. She is the president and CEO and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy, and she is always joining us to tell us all this great stuff about doing philanthropy thoughtfully and with a great purpose and with a plan and strategically, and we are always so grateful to have her with us. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
I am fabulous, Amy. How are you?
Great. Good to hear your voice. It's been a while since we've had you on, but the marathon is upon us. It is happening tomorrow. In fact, on the way here, I was seeing the police barricades already being dropped off on street corners. So it's on. It's happening. And this time tomorrow, half of it'll be over already. But
it will be.
It is not too late to support the great causes that are attached to the marathon. And I think that's sometimes an overlooked part of it, unless we have a friend running on behalf of a charity, but I think a lot of people don't realize that the marathon itself has some very strong ties to official charity partners.
It does. It does. You know, in 2001 is when it officially began. The Chicago Marathon began saying, yes, we're going to use the marathon as an opportunity for charities to raise money. And in that year, there were only 14 registered. This year, there are more than 170 registered, and there are four that are official charities that, you know, that they say they have a minimum of a certain number of runners, in this case, 500. So you think about it's Advocate Healthcare, the American Red Cross, the Chicago Parks District, or the Ronald McDonald House. But if you actually go on the website of, you know, Bank of America, Chicago Marathon, you can click on the charity icon, and it will actually detail all of the organizations with their logos and what category they're in, and you can click on it and give through CrowdRise, which is the official platform that Bank of America is using to raise money.
Excellent. And there are so many. I really, really love seeing those team jerseys out there. I've run for a couple of charities myself, and I think it's a great way to raise money for great causes, especially when you start looking at all the different charities. It's so great to be able to pick one that's really aligned with something. And there's always so many beautiful stories. You know, this time of year, everybody's Facebook feed, it seems like everybody knows someone running in there. If not this race, another one soon. And it seems like everyone's got this beautiful story of, you know, I'm running on behalf of this person or my own struggle or whatever. And there's so many lovely stories attached to that. But it's not too late. Even though it is tomorrow, early in the morning, everything's starting off, people can still support these charities that are recognized by the marathon.
They absolutely can. You know, again, we have that access to the internet and to the webpage of the Chicago Marathon. And if you go onto that page and click on the charity icon, you can go and you can absolutely still donate. But there's other ways to get involved. You know, the marathon is a huge volunteer opportunity. More than 10,000 people volunteer for the marathon. And, you know, if you have a friend who's saying they're volunteering, you know, there's going to be people who oversleep tomorrow morning or people go out tonight and have a lot of fun and aren't going to show up and they're going to need help. So you can volunteer to help for the marathon. You can just say that you're supporting somebody who's running. Say that you know one of these great stories, that somebody's running to support American Cancer Society and those that have breast cancer. You know, October is Pink Month. It's the Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Or, you know, I worked with a group that had all the domestic violence organizations came together, and they had a logo that says, "Let's run domestic violence out of town." And I thought it was so clever, you know. And all of us know these stories about friends that have had things happen in their families, whether it's loved ones that get ill or family members and that have survived it. And you can just, if you can't volunteer, you don't have the resources to donate, everybody has a way of communicating with folks, either through social media or if you're sitting around talking to friends this weekend and talk about the causes that you care about, and that the Chicago Marathon is so rich in providing this opportunity for teams to run, individuals to run within those teams to raise money to support their favorite causes.
Absolutely. I've seen signs out along the course that just said, you know, thank you, St. Jude's runners, or thank you, American Cancer Society runners. And that person may or may not have had a personal connection to anyone in the race, but felt strongly enough about that cause. So that's an option too. But let's not overlook the benefit of just standing beside, you know, beside the course and cheering runners on, whether you know someone out there or not. It might feel a little silly, but it's so important to do. I've been on both sides of that, and I know it is so important, and it's so helpful, even if it's a complete stranger, just have someone standing there cheering as you're slogging through those miles.
Well, you know, I am not a runner. I'm a walker, but not a runner. And when I think about somebody running, you know, 26.2 miles, I'm like, oh my gosh, I would want to be cheered on. And absolutely, being on the course and cheering is so important. And make a sign. You know, we're all about, you know, supporting each other. America's this great country where neighbor helps neighbor. You know, Amy, you and I have talked about that, especially around the holidays. We talk about how, you know, we're always reaching a hand out and we're helping people, you know, whether we're providing food baskets or we're saying to folks, you know, do you have enough? Are you okay? Think about just what happened with Hurricane Matthew raging through the South, that Americans really are a generous people. And, you know, one of the things that we all have available to us is time. You know, maybe you have some time tomorrow on your hands, that you have some time that you can go and stand and have a sign or just scream at the top of your voice, you know, like, way to go, you know, keep at it, because those runners are really doing it to raise money for a cause that's near and dear to their heart, and having somebody smiling and holding a sign and cheering them on means the world.
Truly. And I love that. That's always such an important part of your message, Lisa, about how there's always something that you can do, even if it's not financially feasible right now. There's, you know, you can give time, you can give emotional support. There's always things to do. And giving does not always mean money. And I think that's such a valuable part of your message. There's one other thing that I would add to that. And the reason is because this was done to me. The first marathon that I ran, my coach put a piece of duct tape with my name on it on the front of my shirt. I said, I don't want that on there. No, I don't know anyone here. It was in another city. And she said, trust me, at the end of this race, you are going to be so glad to hear a stranger yell your name. And indeed, I was. So if anyone is running tomorrow, don't be shy about putting your name on whatever you're wearing, because especially if it's your first race, you're going to be so happy if a person says, you know, go Susan or whatever your name is.
Right. Go Chris, go Gary, go George, whatever it is, you know, keep running, keep at it. And I think it's important, you know, to be supportive of your friends when they do that training throughout the year. You know, for those of us like me who aren't a runner, it might seem like, oh gosh, that's just, you know, something that happens and there's street closures. I mean, I've had a number of friends going, oh my gosh, I'm late because the streets were already closed. Right. And I was like, no, think about it in a very positive way, that folks are coming together. There's 45,000 people, you know, that get to run in the Chicago Marathon. It's one of the world stage marathons. It's a qualifier for Boston. And it's all got all this high profile stuff, yet it still dedicates resources and time and effort to allowing charities and individuals to run and raise money for the causes that they care about. So it's not just for the elite runners, and it's not for those who, you know, are trying to get to Boston and some of the other the races, the world stage races. They're actually saying, you know what, this is an important part. You know, and when you think about it, we're raising almost $20 million a year. $20 million gets raised now by these runners. That's not insignificant, and that makes an impact in our community. So whether you can give dollars, and I encourage folks, go on the website, just simply Google, you know, Chicago Marathon, and it will come up, and go to the charity icon and make a $10 donation, a $20 donation to your favorite cause. If you can't do that, think about volunteering, you know, helping out. If you have a friend or you know somebody, there's also places to sign up on the website. And if you can't do that, show up to the race and cheer folks on. Or at least don't be angry and hostile and put that negative emotion out there when you're driving right by the closures of the streets. Take a deep breath and know that people are really doing good by running.
Right. It's an election year. We have enough negativity going on right now. Oh. Let's put a little bit of positivity out there. Indeed. And it's 45,000 people from countries around the world. And I always think that's very touching to see someone running with a flag from another country, especially when you see people running from different countries that perhaps those countries don't get along on the world stage. But there they are running towards a common goal for a great cause.
And all 50 states, you know, all 50 states are represented, and runners of all ilks and sizes and places in their life. And yet they come together in this moment to say, this is an important event. And so many of them. You know, think about it. 170, there's 170 plus charities, and you have to have a minimum of 35 on your team. There are a lot of people running for charity tomorrow. There are a lot of people running for charity, running to raise awareness, running to honor somebody, running to say this person was important to me, is important to me, they suffered from Alzheimer's, breast cancer, ALS, you know, dementia, whatever it is, and I'm going to do something that honors them. And what we can simply do, you know, if nothing else, put that good energy out there in the world and say, I'm going to not, you know, honk my horn or curse under my breath or put that negativity out there. I'm going to say thank you. Thank you for doing what you did to honor that person, to raise money, to raise awareness for that cause.
Yes. And when you see people running around with the Mylar capes and the medals later in the day tomorrow, stop and say good job. It goes a long way.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for participating. Thank you for, you know, whatever. We don't give out enough compliments. You know, Amy, you and I have talked about this. You know, one of the three things I try to do every day is pay a genuine compliment. If you can do nothing else tomorrow, pay a genuine compliment. People have their bib numbers on. Say thanks. Thanks. Did you raise money? Did you run for charity? My guess is if you ask three people, two of them will say yes.
Absolutely. Lisa Dietland, President and CEO of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Happy Saturday, everyone, and happy marathon day.
Happy marathon indeed. And I will see you out there tomorrow cheering, I'm sure.
All right. Absolutely.
Great. All right, everybody. We're going to take a little break and come back in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. I hope you are outside enjoying some of that sunshine. It is lovely. It's a little chilly, but it is lovely out there. So I hope you are getting to enjoy some of it. Still lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Many, many things. We're going to be talking about Facebook's new marketplace feature, which is pretty interesting. We're going to be talking about that on the other side of the news. But you know what? Right now, I want to talk about this story that was on Bloomberg that is really, really interesting. It is all about how retailers are blaming the election for poor sales. And a few weeks ago, gosh, it could have already been maybe a month or two ago, we were talking on the show about how Jared, the jeweler, as in he went to Jared, they were talking about how their engagement ring sales were down, and they were kind of pinning that on the feedback they were getting was, well, people don't want to make major life decisions leading up to the election, which maybe a unscientific bit of survey data that they have there. But nonetheless, so Bloomberg has written about this and lots of retailers. So the Gap CEO, Art Peck, said the election here in the United States is a level of uncertainty that's probably unsettling consumers right now. We heard from the Yum brand CEO, it's KFC, Taco Bell, all those. Greg Creed also said just recently, there is just great uncertainty as to what is going to happen in the U.S. In particular, as a result of the outcome of the election, it goes without saying that people are sort of trying to decide who to choose and what the impact will be on the economy. People may be hunkering down a little bit. Interesting. I'd be curious if you want to give us a text, 312-981-7200, if you have maybe changed any of your shopping or buying habits as a result of the election. I don't know that I have. Have you, Griffin?
I don't know. It's hard to tell, but I remember we talked about this with the engagement ring story like a month or two ago.
Time flies. I said a few weeks.
They were sort of blaming it on that, and we sort of wrote that off. We were laughing about it.
Well, sure we did. We called it highly unscientific data.
And I want to apologize. No, no, but I mean, this one does seem a little more legit, right? It's that reading that story, I thought, maybe. Well, I was a little more swayed, I'll say.
I mean,
because there were more people saying it in different industries.
We have six or seven CEOs here of some major U.S. brands who have said, you know, on no uncertain terms, we believe this is why this is happening. It could be economic, and people are, you know, we always are looking for an explanation when the numbers don't come in as we prefer them to. But it could be. It absolutely could be the case. Wendy's CEO said there is a lot of uncertainty in the consumer's mind as we work through the election. Signet CEO said there is a presidential election which is unique this year and I think has some very unique characteristics that could be affecting the mindset of middle America consumers until we get through this. Let's see. We also heard from the Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen, Inc. The chief financial officer said, we see gas prices being lower. You see unemployment being lower. But But what we also see is that there is more uncertainty with the consumer. We're not too sure what's causing that. So he gave some wiggle room on that one. But our speculation would be, we think there is a rather unusual election going on, and we think the unusual election is causing some certainty. Our number 312-981-7200. Hi, Karen. You're on WGN.
Hi there. My name is Karen. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a retailer for decades in Evanston, independent. I'm not going to give you her name. I didn't ask her for permission.
Okay.
But she said her business is way down. And I just started thinking about over my purchases, and it's like I was thinking of doing something like selling and buying larger housing, and I'm like, I don't want to. This election is just terrifying me.
It's a weird one, that's for sure.
It's not, you're tossing it off as weird. I look at this as a catastrophe in the making. Remember, Adolf Hitler was elected in 1933. Why do you think that we're any better than they were in 1933?
Right.
I am terrified that this man, this monster, will be elected. I'm a woman. You know, I have friends that are gay. I have friends that are Mexican-American. I care about these people. There's a physician I know, again, the nameless. He's head of research at Northwestern into, like, ALS, Lou Gehrig's, Parkinson's, dementia. I mean to tell you, trust me, there is somebody in your life who will be aided by this precious man's research. And this man is a Pakistani immigrant and a Muslim. And frankly, speaking for myself, it's worth about 1,000 of me. You know, and to hear Donald Trump say what he says, I take him seriously. It's like that joke.
I hear you,
when
Karen.
A person shows you who they are, believe them.
Absolutely. Thank you for the call, Karen. Unfortunately, we do have to go to break and go to news and all that, but I appreciate you sharing your opinion with us, Karen. Indeed, there's a lot of uncertainty around this election, a lot of strong feelings, as we were talking about a little bit earlier on the program. I was in for Kathy O'Malley on the Kathy and Judy show, and we opened by talking about this, especially the last 24 hours of things that have come out of the Trump campaign. So this, not so much a political show, though, but we are certainly looking at numbers, looking at the market, all that. But we're going to go to news. When we come back, we're talking about Facebook's new marketplace. It's a new feature. It's supposed to kind of be competing with like eBay and Craigslist and all that. It's already doing some interesting things, maybe not quite what they planned for them to. So we're going to be talking about that on the other side of the news. But let's take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the program, lots of things to talk about, lots of tech and business headlines in the world, and we're going to try to get to as many of them as we can. Facebook has unveiled a new feature called Marketplace. They're aiming at kind of that Craigslist, eBay competitor spot, really. And tech reporter for CNN, Hope King, joins us now by phone to tell us more about it. Hi, Hope.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Great. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Marketplace has launched. Immediately, I think I saw a couple of outlets reporting that it didn't take long before drugs, ammunition, porn, animals, plants, all kinds of things were being sold on Marketplace, things that are regulated people try to regulate them on eBay and Craigslist, and they're against terms of service. But tell us about how the launch has gone and how it's going and all the aspects of it that perhaps we're not seeing so far.
Yeah, so it launched Monday morning and Facebook was quite excited. It's been trying to do this for a while now and finally, you know, thought that it had a great way to get people to sell and buy things on their phone through Facebook. But they said that they left out something, I guess, as a technical issue that prevented them from stopping these illegal products from being posted and seen. And a lot of fun, weird, and strange things started popping up. I think, like you said, there were people trying to sell drugs. People were poking fun at the feature, selling bottles of water for $56. People were selling their babies and girlfriends. So you had, you know, you had people having fun with it, obviously using the audience that Facebook has, a billion people every day, to kind of get their jokes out. But then there were people who were legitimately trying to, you know, find some customers for whatever it is that they wanted to get rid of.
And so there, it seems like Facebook first kind of took a stab in this in some foreign markets. They didn't start this in the U.S. I think in particular in South Asia, Southeast Asia, it seems like where they were kind of beta testing this feature. And what does it seem like so far is the most successful kind of niche of what people are buying and selling through this tool so far?
Yeah, you're right. They like to test it in smaller markets where they have a where they have better control over the population, you know, smaller countries, smaller user bases. And they haven't really released information about what's been most successful, but you know, at least in the U.S., in the last couple of weeks, as they started to expand marketplace, the usual stuff that people are selling are kind of, you know, furniture, small items around the house, clothing, things like that. But they haven't really released anything kind of publicly to say these are the things that they've been seeing. What they have said is, look, people have been using Facebook groups to buy and sell things for a while now, and they kind of wanted to formalize that process and consolidate all of those listings into one place so that people don't have to hunt around for a particular group to buy what they need. They can look for the things that they want that are nearby, close to them, locally.
Right. And then already have it kind of accessible to your own network, because that's what I see people do a lot. They'll take out a Craigslist ad and then immediately post it to Facebook and say, guys, by the way, I'm selling this. If any of you want it, come let me know.
Exactly. I think the cool thing that the marketplace feature offers that Craigslist doesn't is, you know, it kind of takes the spookiness away of buying secondhand goods. You know, Craigslist is fun, but there's always that element of, you know, who is this person I'm talking to? Are they really in the location mm-hmm. that they say they are? When you're on Facebook, you know, you do see a little bit of the seller's information, their basic profile information. You see a photo. You get to message with them if you don't like the price or if you want to make arrangements. It's a little bit more of a secure, you know, way to kind of validate that the person you're talking to is, you know, not a bot or that it's not somebody who's trying to scam you.
Right. Well, it's the same reason that I think so many media companies turn to Facebook commenting, because you on some level have to stand behind your identity to your to your networks. You have to, you know, you can't be a creep on Facebook or on Craigslist.
Exactly.
You know, you have to let people know who you are, and you have to stand behind your name, of course. So there was also a whisper for a while, probably about a year and a half ago, maybe even longer, about Facebook wanting to play in the crowdfunding space and kind of create their version of Indiegogo and Kickstarter and that kind of thing, for much of the same reason. Not only was it just kind of money being left on the table, but it also seemed like people were already importing those campaigns and those ads, you know, those things over to their mm-hmm. Facebook network. Why not just use mm-hmm. them there, where it's already so much easier to share and already accessible to your network? Does it seem like that is the step that's going to follow that? Because it certainly seems like they had to get e-commerce figured out before they could move to crowdfunding large amounts of money.
Yeah, I think they're not going to leave anything off the table when it comes to using the network it has to try to do as much as possible. So they're always experimenting. To your point about crowdfunding, you know, they started, you know, a couple of years ago to give nonprofits the ability to put like a donate button on their pages. They've gotten, you know, better at giving smaller businesses the option to kind of create little marketplaces on their own pages and then adding like a buy button. So to that e-commerce point that you made, as well, they have tried this. And, you know, I don't know how aggressively they'll kind of pursue that. They have to be careful. They can't just inundate the platform with tons of new features all the time, because it will get really confusing. It'll, you know, if you look at the Facebook app now, there's so many buttons.
Lot.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one reason why they're starting to break out some of these services into their own apps, which, for some people, you know, it's annoying to have to download another app. But for them, you know, if they feel that there are certain people who only want to use Facebook for crowdfunding, for example, hey, maybe if they test it and it works out well and there's enough people, that might warrant its own app, and then they don't have to go on to the main Facebook app and deal with everything else. So I think for them, you know, they'll continue to test in these smaller markets. They'll continue to test every little kind of potential feature, but they do kind of have to be careful about how frequently they roll out these new things and kind of push people to use them.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, we saw when Facebook just changed the font of its logo. I think people lost their minds over that. People are not wired for change. So there's always pushback for that one. And when giving people more to do, when giving Facebook users more to do. But nonetheless, I think the latest data was that 1 in 7 people on the earth are using Facebook.
Yep.
So, you know, it makes sense to have it all in one place, of course. All right.
Yeah.
Hope King, tech reporter at CNN, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the most innovative companies right here in Chicago. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your sunny and beautiful Saturday afternoon with me. I'm very thankful to you for that. Hope you're enjoying some of that sunshine. It is lovely. It's chilly, but it's lovely out there. Beautiful autumn day. All right, my friends. You know, we talk a lot about different companies on this program, but certainly we always like to talk about companies right here in Chicago that are doing cool things. And Crane's Chicago Business is always looking to that too, always talking about that and making lots of wonderful lists for us. And we're joined now by John Pletz, who's a technology reporter at Crane's Chicago Business, to talk with us about some of the most innovative companies right here in Chicago. Hi there. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Amy.
Hey, thanks for being with us today. So talk to me about some of these companies. And before you do, though, tell me about what criteria you use to determine how you are defining innovative and what qualifies, really.
What we do is we look at the list of patents granted every year, and we sort those by companies here in Illinois and Chicago. And then there's a company here in town called Ocean Tomo, which does a lot of work with patent valuations. And they analyze not only the amount of patents that people get, they also look at how good those patents are, you know, how interesting is the innovation, how unique is it, and that's how we cut the list. You know, it's how likely are companies to spend on those patents, defend those patents, turn them into products, that sort of thing.
Wonderful. So tell us about what we saw this year as you're looking through this list that you compiled. What was surprising to you, or who was kind of out of nowhere, out of the blue this year?
There's a lot of them. I mean, the most interesting thing about the list is it really just sort of covers the waterfront of, you know, the Chicago economy. So it's everything from manufacturing to, you know, the traditional high-tech companies. So there were some really interesting companies in there that I hadn't seen before. There's a little, oddly enough, they make food processing equipment, a company called Provisor out in on the southwest suburbs. And, you know, they... you know, you don't think that that's the most high-tech thing in the world until you realize that almost all kinds of manufacturing and products are now getting either connected to computers, so they've got touchscreens or computer-controlled. You've got companies like Medtronic, also out in the suburbs, makes battery testing equipment. They've been on our list a number of times. And if you think about how your car is basically a computer on wheels, you know, That is pretty tricky to start running the diagnostics on things like that. And if you think about electric vehicles, you know, those batteries are very, very different than batteries you had in your car 20 years ago. And now, you know, you're seeing old line equipment get connected to the cloud. So
right.
it's really amazing.
Right. I thought it was really interesting kind of looking over this list of just the wide variety of topics. I mean, the words online dating popped out as soon as I saw that, my eyes went to the word bacon. And so there's so much interesting stuff there. So Provisor, the one that we're talking about, what I thought was interesting when I first looked at that, I was like, what could possibly be innovative about, you know, pork belly? But nonetheless, it's like about scanners and lasers and cameras to vary the size, the thickness of a slice of bacon, which is so interesting. We don't think about, as you said, we don't necessarily think about bacon being an area for a lot of innovation, but or food processing in general. But indeed, it really is kind of on everything now. Every industry that we touch, innovation is welcome and there and present.
And you get some great, you know, traditional names. There are a couple of companies on that list that have been around for 100 years. from a little company called Cummins Allison that's been on our list that does currency counting machines. And they're just an amazingly innovative company, constantly reinventing their business. I mean, they used to make, drills before that business got commoditized. Now they make some extraordinarily high-tech equipment. You've got, companies like Wilson, been around for over 100 years. And if you look at the advances in, everything from golf clubs to basketballs to, in this case, some of the tennis rackets are coming out with, they don't just, sort of wing it. There's a lot of engineering that goes on behind it. And that's what's sort of fascinating, is you see these companies reinventing themselves, as well as new companies like the one you talked about, Mattersight, which does artificial intelligence to help figure out callers' personalities, to help call centers do what they do more efficiently.
It is really so interesting. I mean, yeah, Wilson is another great example of where they're re-engineering the tennis racket, which I think is really interesting, too, when we see older companies that are not that's not the right way to say it. I was going to say not as attached to their legacy business, but at least willing to depart from it, I think, is where I think it's very exciting, because a lot of times older companies are like, we got built on this product or this way of doing things. And not only does that make for a lack of innovation, facing to the consumer, but it certainly, I think, usually makes the company culture feel that way, feel like it's very attached to, quote unquote, the way things have always been. And I think that that kind of culture stifles innovation.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, I mean, some of these companies really do have some just tremendously innovative cultures. They're very proud of them. And a lot of them are privately held companies you don't hear about very often, but, they really are thriving.
And so is that about leadership, or is that, what is it in the culture of those companies, particularly the older ones, that have been able to reinvent themselves time and time again to keep that spirit, or to maybe bring that spirit back after a lull or something like that?
They're just very entrepreneurial companies. They're very driven. They don't attract a lot of attention. They're not very flashy, but they understand that the only way they stay in business, as a product or a company matures, the only way you stick around is by reinventing yourself, either with new products or making your products better and more efficient. Like the company we talked about, that bacon slicer, you think about the technology that went into that, and they're not doing technology for technology's sake. Mm-hmm. They're doing it because it helps their customers save money, be more efficient. And, it just, you got to constantly sort of, push it.
Yeah, for sure. There's also on this list, biotech stands out, I think, which is an interesting place because it seems like there's a lot of very exciting biotech innovation coming out of Chicago. I think we think about innovation being attached to Silicon Valley, but I think the Silicon Prairie is holding its own, particularly in the area of biotech. I know University of Chicago has been made a big investment in that area, but it seems like there's a lot around IV medicine, pumps, generic drugs, things like that. That's also an area of great innovation.
It is, and Chicago has a huge asset base there. Not a lot of places do, but when you think about having the pharma and med device companies like Abbott, like Baxter, like Takeda, like Horizon, some of those companies, you get that sort of density and that sort of critical mass, and you get a lot of innovation. And Chicago is very fortunate to have that base. Not everybody does, and you see that every year in this list. Those are some of the most innovative companies around. The R&D is tremendously expensive and difficult, which is why you see a lot of companies that, you'll see the innovation, the patents, and you'll see those get acquired very quickly.
Right, certainly. And in biotech, too, I think the stakes are so much higher, really. I mean, not that bacon slicing innovation is not important to people having breakfast. But, with biotech, it feels like the stakes are so much higher because we're talking about lives literally being on the line, which I think is what feeds the scandals when we see, price gouging and things like that attached to big pharma and executives in the biotech area.
Yeah, it's much more critical. And I think, over the next 5 to 10 years, the pace and type of innovation you're going to see out of biotech is just going to be breathtaking, because now you've got the intersection of what we know about genetics and what we're learning about genetics applied to what we know about medicine. And it's just amazing. And you're seeing a lot of the Chicago companies really sort of at the leading edge of that.
Yeah, truly, truly. So what do you think this time next year when you're making this list, what do you think, trends you'll see or what does it seem like is just kind of just now on the horizon that we'll probably be seeing more of in Chicago in terms of innovative companies?
You're going to see more of the genetics for sure. You're going to see much more data analytics across any number of companies, whether that's industrial or whether that's, internet and e-commerce. And you're going to see a lot more big data as well. I think over the long term, you're going to see much more of what they call the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. which is a lot of traditional equipment and devices, like a lot of the stuff on this list. You know, a lot of the innovation that was on there is about how you connect that to the cloud and other devices, pull more data from it. So I think you're going to see that for a long time to come. I think we're just at the beginning of that. You're going to see a lot of artificial intelligence, which you're already seeing crop up in that list. And we've got some very, very good companies in Chicago doing some great work in that.
Yeah, definitely. We really do. It's a cool time for Chicago, and I love the kind of specialty subsections that are popping up, like biotech and like big data and things like that, that really people are starting to look to Chicago to really hold that space, which is very cool. John Pletz, tech reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, thanks so much for being with us today.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and then get you to news and then turn you over to our good friend King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.